Hello and welcome to the Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable soccer analytics podcast. I am Michael Cayley. I have been watching soccer occasionally. I have occasionally taken a break from other things to watch soccer, and that's why I am prepared to record a soccer podcast, as I normally do, on a weekly basis. All of these things are regular and moving forward, and nothing has disrupted my life significantly. I'm talking to Mike Goodman right now, and he has been telling me that also nothing has disrupted his life recently, and so he is prepared to discuss soccer on a normal schedule. Is that right, my good friend?
Absolutely. The music you heard on the way in is the Whalers. Max is not with us on the other side of the virtual glass tonight. Please download, subscribe, make us happy as podcasters. I am totally prepared, as a soccer professional that I am, to talk about soccer. I have watched soccer? Question mark. I have certainly edited things about soccer. I have soccer opinions that many on the internet may disagree with. So let us discuss the soccer with an assist from our wonderful listeners who have once... I feel like we say this every time, but the level of questions we get, like, reliably what ends up happening is we do two shows when we're planning to do one on questions.
Yeah, because there's just too many good ones. And they, like, they organize a podcast. You put them together, you sort of, like, we space them out, we throw them back and forth. Okay... that just makes a coherent podcast, and let's do that.
Right.
So that's just what we're going to do. Should we just get started? We've got a bunch of questions. We've got several questions that are more technical. I'm going to talk about a few of those. There's a couple of questions I wanted to get to that are really just about, not about soccer analytics, but about soccer data. And what it means, which I think are like really important questions to get into, and we will. I wanted to do a couple of those.
Let's just start there. Hit me with one. I live for these kinds of questions.
Exactly. So this one is from Hussein Mula. Asks, need help trying to understand something basic here, but confusing to me. And this is legitimately confusing. Like, don't feel bad, Hussein. Made up scenario: say Wan-Bissaka plays a cross. The keeper misses it. The ball lands at Bruno, who is standing 5 centimeters away from the goal line with an open net. He miskicks it. The ball rolls through Bruno's legs. Would that be recorded as a chance or not? Will it be given an XG value, and why?
Woof! So, to make you feel better about this, let me say that I have on the inside... been talking with data modeling people and data collection people about these marginal cases. And you don't need to go to hypotheticals. Like the Choupo-Moting miss, which everybody knows, is one example where the ball is basically played backwards at the goal line by the forward. Manchester City had one in the Champions League this year in the group stages. I can't remember who it was exactly, where it almost looked like the player was clearing it off the line as they tried to deaden the ball in the net. And do you call those shots and or chances or not is actually, like, it's confusing.
And Timo Werner a couple weeks ago had one,
yes,
where he – it's still unclear. I've watched the replay a bunch of times because it was funny, and it's still unclear whether his first touch was an attempted shot that went backward or he was attempting to, for reasons that escape me, like control the ball with his first touch literally on the goal line.
My belief is that every time Timo Werner can try to control the ball, he tries to control the ball. And that this is what leads to a number of the horrific-looking misses, which would actually be, like, incredibly high-opportunity shots if he controlled the ball.
Yeah. But what do you do with that touch, where it is unclear what a player's intention was, and then the question of... There's both the question of the unclear intention, and then there's a question of what do you do when a player just doesn't hit the ball at all?
Yeah. Now... My understanding is that Opta does have this category of thing which is a chance but not a shot. That is relatively rare, but exists for categorizing exactly those moments.
Yeah, they call it a missed chance.
There you go.
And this is a classic. This is what that category exists for. Would love to have a data stringer back on the program. We did one a while back with Conrad Appia, who
it's like 3.5 years ago at this point, because it was while I was on my first paternity leave from the show.
Yeah. And he sort of broke down what you do as a stringer, which was, I thought, completely fascinating. Like they're watching the game and they are very quickly from picking a place on the field where something happened and marking who did it and what it was.
Look, and a lot of doing good data collection is like quality control and, you know, having somebody overlooking these things to make sure that they're good, and like you're ranking all your stringers to like make sure that they're doing accurate jobs. You're also developing sort of like input software to make sure that like it's easy for them to quickly put these things in. You're doing categorization work to make sure that they're not having to make judgment calls unless you're intentionally making them make judgment calls, like with big chances in Opta. But like, you're attempting to make sure that they're not having to make as little judgment as possible, as opposed to just recording things. And there are ways to set up data flow to do that. But like, you cannot workflow your way around some of these edge cases.
Yeah. And so, like, with this specific question with Opta, I honestly don't remember exactly how it would be handled in StatsBomb's data. But in Opta, this specific thing would be called a missed chance. It would be given, and I have in my system XG values for missed chances. I don't really know what to do with them. I mean, you can't really, like, you have to pretend they're shots,
right?
And they're not. And so it doesn't really, like, it is a kludge in my system, but I feel like if there are situations where a player really, really clearly should have taken a shot and they didn't, you'd rather give that a value than that you didn't give that a value. So that's what I do. But it is not a simple question. And then an even more complicated question is trying to identify exactly what a shot is.
Yeah. But, you know, and like both from these big, obvious swing XG moments, but also, like, when Harry Winks tries to play in a deep cross and it ends up finding the back of the net, we call that a shot by default because it goes in. But he wasn't trying to shoot that. And quite frankly, if he hits that purely, or not purely, but differently, and it just floats over the end line, we don't call it a shot. You know, there's obviously a subset of shots where you're trying to lob the keeper from, you know, 40, 50 yards because you see the keeper off their line. And that's fine. That's easy enough to deal with. But something where you're mishitting a cross, or you're mishitting, a long pass and it ends up in the back of the net, well, like, look, that gets credited as a shot. But when you mishit it and it doesn't go in the net, even if it's close, it's not a shot. And, like, there's not a ton we can do about that.
Here's a fun little story about regression modeling. Because for the most part, if you get a free kick right near the sideline, you're not really going to shoot.
Ah, yes.
But occasionally, if you get a free kick from right near the sideline, what you're going to do is sort of hit one of those bending balls that you're kind of hoping that the keeper can't move to the far. It's going to angle into the far post, but the keeper can't go to the far post because they've got to protect against a possible shot, and it eventually goes in. And if you do a dumb regression model on shot outcomes, what it will find is that free kicks from near the sideline are incredibly valuable chances that are very likely to be scored, because shots from there are scored at incredibly high rates because they're not shots. But occasionally you get one from there that goes in and it becomes a shot. And this is, like, the data does that. I don't know. I don't think there's, like, some secret solution to the data. It means you need to understand what your data is.
Right. I would say that, like, I mean, part of what we're looking at here is if you're good at modeling and you're good at using data, when you build a model over a big enough sample, and that sample isn't that big, these things even out, as long as you are aware of their existence and you take it into account when creating a model. So, like, none of this stuff is, like, forget fatal. None of this stuff really makes XG models particularly worse, as long as you're accounting for it. But when you shift from trying to use something like expected goals as a predictive forward-looking model that takes 3 to 5 to 10 to 15 games of a season into account, and, you know, seasons upon seasons upon seasons of data to build on, to sort of make value judgments about how good or bad a team is and how they will perform going forward, when you shift from that to using it to describe a given game, to describe a match, to describe a shot, to describe a half, whatever, now all of a sudden these descriptive issues that mostly can aggregate out if you're working well with the data become quite large. I mean, they're like, you have to that's when it becomes using expected goals as a descriptive tool means you have to have some degree of understanding of how the model works so you could understand the ways in which the model is misrepresenting single size or single half or single match values to you and adjust accordingly in your explanation.
Yeah. And I think that, like, and I think this also generally goes to the problem that soccer has only, you know, 15 years of these terms meaning specific things.
Yeah.
The term shot, the term dribble, the term tackle have always been things that people have said about soccer, but they haven't had particularly technical definitions for the most part that have been really discussed and agreed upon and necessary for understanding since the data collection era, which begins with Opta in the mid-2000s. And so we're sort of having these questions of exactly what is a shot, exactly what is the name for these moments, because we're trying to sort out this game in data terms in a new way over the last 15 years. And, like, this is one of the things that's fun about soccer data. We're still sort of figuring out our terms, even.
But yeah.
I think that, like, for the kinds of folks who listen to this podcast who are trying to understand soccer in this technical way and trying to make sense of the terms that are being thrown at them by, say, soccer podcasters who've spent a lot of time on this, like, these terms are still in process. And they don't mean exactly the same thing in Opta's data or in StatsBomb's data. And they don't mean exactly the same thing when we talk about them. And, like, we're still working it out. So, like, if you're struggling to pick up on different things, and these are great places to, like, toss us questions in the comments, but, like, that's just normal.
Yeah.
That's where soccer data and soccer analytics is as a process.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, one thing to understand about, like, the idea of building models and stuff is that a lot of what you're doing is aggregating out the art in order to get at the science. But as you go backwards and you want to use, you know, numbers to explain the game as opposed to just sort of make very vanilla predictions, like, the art comes back in. And, like, it is mostly meaningless to the point of a model to argue about whether or not something was a shot. It is very much not meaningless to a description of a match to argue about that, right? Like if I'm going to say that, like, Manchester City, they lost 2-1, but they had 3 expected goals. Well, if, like, 0.8 of those expected goals came on one of these contested moments, then it very much matters how we're describing these things when we're talking about that match. So, like, I harp on this point a lot. But the nature of specifically expected goals, and then, like, when you step out, expected assists or expected goals assisted, whatever, as well, is that they have this duality to them. And that things that matter for one part of it, one use, maybe don't matter for another use. But there are different uses for the tool. And I just think it's, like, It is important when you're trying to wrap your brain around these things to understand which problems that you're facing that exist are problems in which arena. So that you can have a lot of explanatory problems that are worthwhile arguing about and fighting about and digging your teeth into. While those also don't really impact expected goals' predictive purposes. And on the flip side, you can look at, like, places where expected goals has missed badly predictively and sort of dig in and try to figure out if there's a reason, and that those kinds of reasons are not going to be the same problems necessarily that you're trying to grapple with explanatorily. So, I mean, all of which is to say, yes, these are complicated problems that don't have easy answers, and that's good.
Yeah, so one of the reasons that your questions are so good and they take us lots of podcasts is we spend 12 minutes on those sorts of questions, and thank you for enjoying our podcast. It really surprises and means a lot to us. All right, so what you got next?
I have a really good one here that I like. Well, it's kind of two because they argued about it a little bit in the comments.
Yeah.
So Ray Sales asked us, since Pep's time, how underwhelming has City's conversion rate been? I've always had the feeling throughout Pep's tenure, even the title-winning seasons, that they've been anything but clinical. Extending on the question above, how good has City's post-shot expected goal been throughout Pep's tenure? Post-shot expected goal per shot, whatever. As much as they create a lot of quality chances, it doesn't seem like they place the shots in good locations. Also, is there any indication that City's passing from the three central midfielders has been overwhelmingly negative according to the numbers? That's a little bit of a separate question, which we can put aside. That's from Ray Sales, and James Dyerly responded in the comments, City has been 9, 12, and 26 goals above XG the previous three seasons, ! And I wanted to address this question because I think that there is a really interesting dichotomy going on here. Which I suppose I will get to after I give you a chance to answer this question. Do you think City's finishing has been underwhelming? Or do you sort of view it as, yeah, no, they've just finished over XG, what do you expect?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, a couple pieces of this, but one important thing is that the best teams finish above their expected goals.
Right.
And a big part of that, and I've got a old article on it from the Washington Post Fancy Stats blog, a big part of that is that the best teams buy players who are really good at kicking the ball, and then they score more of their shots. And you can see this, like the players that get picked up by the biggest teams in the world. I think I looked at Real Madrid and Barcelona. Like Alexis Sanchez, when he was on Udinese and then when he was on Arsenal, also scored lots and lots of his shots. Because Alexis Sanchez is amazing at shooting, and then he also scored lots of his shots at Barcelona. Like, they pick up the best players. And so when a team like Man City is, like, 9 and 12 goals above XG, that's not great. That's fine. But it will, I think, be experienced as not amazing because you kind of expect Kevin De Bruyne and Sergio Aguero to score significantly more of their shots than you'd expect. You'd expect them to score more shots than expected. You know what I mean. And so, like, those numbers, I think that, like, James Dyerly is right that the 9 and the 12 are good. You shouldn't think that this team is, like, being screwed over on XG. But those aren't great finishing numbers given the quality of players that City has. 26 is. Other seasons under Pep, they've been great. But recently, their finishing has indeed not been amazing.
So, I want to bring something kind of cool in, which is post-shot expected goals here.
Yeah.
And because if you look at a post-shot expected goal model, and you look at Manchester City, they finish below. Their post-shot expected goals are actually they're shooting goals added, right? So you look at, say, your expected goals, the expected goals of your shots on target minus your total expected goals is lower than their expected goals across the last three seasons, each of the last three seasons. So despite the fact that they are scoring significantly more goals than expected goals, so it is understandable given that that you would watch them play and think to yourself, huh, it feels like they're missing a lot. Even while they are scoring more goals than expected goals. Now, how do you thread that needle? Well, now we get into, like, some questions about post-shot expected goals. And I'm going to, I did this on purpose, I'm going to loop in Bassman93's question here, which is some recent discourse about finishing skill in various measures. One measure I've not seen mentioned is post-shot XG over pre-shot. This feels to me to be a good measure of the value added by the specific shooter. Could you discuss, please? And the answer is kinda? Like, but you run into exactly this problem, where it looks like actually Manchester City are scoring less on post-shot than you would expect, given their shots. But also they end up with more goals. So how do you thread that needle? How do you conceptually understand what is going on here with Manchester City? And the answer is, I think, and I'll throw it back to you here, is that post-shot expected goals is a tough concept to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, like, I suppose that, like, I mean, you don't have a specifically built public post-shot expected goal model for, like, some good reasons, and I feel like we should just sort of, like, maybe spend a minute here talking about what a post-shot expected goal model is, and I have a whole spiel about why it's much more useful for keepers than shooters.
Yeah, because, so what post-shot expected goals is, post-shot is one of those terms that, like, sounds good until you realize what people will think you mean when you say it.
That's a fair point.
Because it doesn't mean the expected goals, like, sometime after the shot. The idea is that expected goals is a statistic that imagines you know nothing about what happens once the player's foot hits the ball. You figure out what the value of the chance is up to the very moment the player's foot or head or, you know, groin hits the ball. And that
other
is...
Other body part, as it were.
And... So
speaking of difficulties measuring, like data measurement, I have always wondered from stringers how far up the leg foot goes until you have to mark it as other body part. Similarly, how far down the head to the torso shoulder area does the head go until it also becomes other body part?
Yeah, deep philosophical questions, really.
What is the hand of God goal? Is the hand of God goal head? Or is it other body part? Because officially, by the refereeing decision, that is a header. And yet...
Yep. That Brazil had a goal in the... There was a Copa America goal.
Yeah.
That was a clear handball goal. It was scored other body part. So that's what I got. But so the idea of post-shot expected goals is that you are looking at the shot itself. You are looking at everything you can know about that shot. In particular, like, if that shot is off target, its post-shot expected goals is zero. It's done. Most post-shot expected goals also say that if that shot is blocked, its post-shot expected goals is zero.
Yes.
And this is, there are, you can debate that. That is not an obvious question. It only comes to have post-shot expected goal value if it is on target. If the keeper, if it is either going to be in the goal, or if it's going to be saved by the keeper, or if it's blocked off the line, which raises the question of why couldn't you count the blocked shots? Like, this is a difficult theoretical problem. And you, what you want to have is real information about how well the shot was hit, which you have on a very general level in most systems. And then you basically have, like, it was a good opportunity to score, which was put into this corner or was put toward the center. And, you know, when you put it into the corner, it's a more likely to be scored than it's put toward the center. And maybe you have something about how hard it was hit. And those are the things that you throw into the model to spit out the likelihood of them being scored.
Right. And so this raises a couple of challenges. First, just generally speaking, once you're adding in keeper positioning, things get very, very difficult. If you are Manchester City and you have played a cutback that has put the keeper well out of position, and thus you have rolled the ball into the middle of the net quite softly and directly, but that the keeper has no chance of saving, what do we view that post-shot expected goal as? Do we demerit the keeper for being out of position and say, actually, this was a shot that very well should have been saved, and therefore, like, the shooter doesn't get a lot of credit? Or, in some way, are we crediting the attacking team for making the keeper be out of position? And the answer is it's very hard to do that. So, generally speaking, good passing work, good creative work that takes a keeper out of position is generally blamed on the keeper. And now, like, that's not a huge problem for like, evaluating keepers, per se. But, like, if you are an attacking team that consistently can pull keepers out of position, it might make your finishing look worse than it is, both to a model and to the eye. Because if you're consistently creating chances where, like, you can easily score, then it doesn't register to you that you're scoring all of those chances, and, like, your finishing feels bad because all the chances are easy. Like, you're creating a higher percentage of chances that, quote-unquote, you should score than either your eye or a model suggests. That's part one. Part two is the on-target, off-target, blocked issue. Now, what I would say is this is, again, to me, not a major issue for evaluating keepers. A keeper is judged on whatever shots end up on target. And, you know, like, obviously a keeper, part of their job is anticipating which parts of the goal will be closed off by defenders and thus, you know, compensating for the open parts of the net and making more saves. But if they're not doing that, that'll get picked up by a model anyway, because they will be letting in more shots in the areas that they should be covering than they would otherwise if they were not properly accounting for the possibility of blocks. But for a shooter, this is a major problem. Because if you are accurately shooting the ball at the corners of the goal, you will hit more of them off target than if you are lazily putting them down the middle that are easy saves for a keeper. And there is information to be gleaned, a lot of information, from missing the frame narrowly that is just entirely absent from a shooting model. To the degree that maximizing your post-shot expected goal will be very, very different than maximizing your actual goal scoring chances once you take everything into account. It is a big, big problem for measuring shooters using post-shot expected goals that off target is zero. How big a problem is up for debate. Like, when you're talking about massive career size sample sizes, maybe not a huge deal, but, like, it's real hard to find signal on this noise, and you kind of need every bit of information. So if you're looking at, like, if you're judging somebody's season or couple of seasons, if they have a few that go narrowly wide in what is actually really skilled shots, it's going to throw things off a lot. Now, that should be counterbalanced eventually by scoring goals, but, like, it's a long time to get to eventually when you're doing post-shot expected goals.
Yeah, I mean, the post-shot expected goal model that I never built and played around with and didn't love, the basic concept that I was working with, because I was thinking about shooters at the time and not goalkeepers, and I still think that, like, you need StatsBomb's snapshot data to do goalkeepers with any reasonable...
Even then, it's a real, like, the positioning issue is a real challenge. Like,
it really is. But just the way I wanted to do it was that the shot was going to be treated not as an XY point, but as a really big blur.
And so, like, you would – so, like, if that really big blur included – part of it included, like, if you missed the very corner of the goal frame by a yard, mm-hmm. a big chunk of that blur would be extremely high value. And that was how I wanted to do it. That was that's how I
that's
think.
That's a clever way. I mean
who was it who did that paper at the StatsBomb conference about analytics for parents?
Oh, it was yeah, give me a sec. I'll look it up. Anyway.
Yeah. But anyway, did this paper looking at the likelihood of scoring based on where you should try to put your shot if you are like pretty bad at shooting versus a little bit better at shooting versus a professional, and like showing statistically the sort of stuff you know. But if you're bad at shooting, you should try to kick the ball right at the center of the goal, because there's a good chance you'll hit it like right in the corner because you're terrible at shooting. It'll be a great chance. And like, because even the best shooter, even the best soccer players, like, we see that happen. They miss the frame. They are not, they should not be aiming for, like, you know, an inch inside the frame. They're aiming several yards or at least several feet inside the frame and then, you know, see what happens. Because it could go a little bit too close to the keeper, it could go perfect, or it could go wide. That's what you should do.
It was Lukas Szczepanski, by the way.
Yes.
Whose name I'm sure I just butchered. I'm sorry, Lukas.
But yeah, but to continue with this question onto Man City and actually talk about the soccer teams and the games that they play for a minute. The question of what is going on with City, is there an indication that City's passing with three central midfielders has been overwhelmingly negative according to the numbers? The answer to this question is no.
Right.
And City are increasingly, like, so, I mean, one important point here is that if you look at the top five in my progressive passes per 90 stat, you've got De Bruyne number one, you've got Grealish number two, you've got Bruno Fernandes number three, and very easily by quite a margin, number four is João Cancelo.
Right.
And at the same time, Gundogan and Rodri show up like in the top 20 or 30 in the progressive passes per 90. What City are doing right now is getting – so Rodri is a good passer of the ball. Cancelo is a fantastic passer of the ball. De Bruyne is a otherworldly passer of the ball. And they are using those guys – to stay, like, to keep, they are able, because of the passing ability of Rodri, Gundogan, Cancelo, and then in a somewhat more forward position, De Bruyne, they can move the ball forward into and around the penalty area without having any of their midfielders take any risks. And I think it must be very, it is very frustrating to watch, but it is a way to create chances while being, right now, I think, pretty clearly the best defensive team in the Premier League.
So I think, and like, one simple way to understand City, right, is that they have the most passes per match in the Premier League in their opponent's half. They have the most passes per match in the attacking third. They have the highest pass percentage in the attacking third, and they, you know, have like, and they also have the highest percent chance on long balls completed, right? Like, this is what they do. And then, unsurprisingly, despite all of that possession, they have the seventh fewest crosses in the final third. So the issue here is not midfielders passing the ball forward. Right, the issue is not moving into the opposition half and then the attacking third. The issue, such as there is one, is that they still want very good chances, but they are incredibly conservative about passing the ball to create those good chances once they are far up the field. They don't cross the ball a lot. They don't play risky passes a lot. They circulate the ball a ton. And this is, in fact, kind of a dramatic difference from previous versions of City.
Yeah, this is not your free eights Pep football. What the free eight system, the way the free eight system worked when they had Silva and De Bruyne running as free eights ahead of Fernandinho, was that they had distribution. What Pep did for defensive stability was that he could keep his fullbacks relatively reserved because both free eights were bombing on and the wingers were high and wide. And so you'd have this situation where you had this very clear demarcation of role where Fernandinho and the eights were moving the ball forward and the wingers were always available for that pass. That pass could be first to move the ball up the field. They would get the ball that moves the ball into the final third, and then to move the ball into the penalty. They would always be available in the penalty area. So you'd have, like, you know, someone, you know, one of the eights or Fernandinho sprays the ball up, or maybe a center back gets the ball up to Sterling or Sané on the wings. They move it infield to De Bruyne and Silva. Silva and De Bruyne then find Sterling and Sané again into the penalty area, who then square it centrally for Aguero, who scores. And that works because both of your eights are pushing way up toward the penalty area, and both of your wingers are pushing into the penalty area. You've got like five guys in and around the penalty area, and it was wonderful. It was just absolutely delightful football, and it requires an inhuman amount of Fernandinho work to work, and it also requires De Bruyne and Silva to do quite a bit of defensive work as well, which they were capable of doing from those free eight positions. This team is not doing that at all. De Bruyne is playing as a 10, and he is protected by two central midfielders and a sort of quasi-central midfield fullback. And when they get the ball up there, the wingers are not getting into the center forward is involved in the build-up more. You can't leave the center forward out of the play until he scores in the same way in this system, and it just slows everything down a lot.
I mean, like, one way to just look at this is, like, having Cancelo, Rodri, and Gundogan in as your, like, progressive chunk of your midfield is a ton of passing. What it isn't is a ton of influence in the interior areas in the final third. Because while Cancelo is sort of adapting into this midfield progressor role, when he gets forward into the final third, it's in fairly traditional spaces because the left-sided winger is almost always right-footed, right? It's either Sterling, sometimes it's Jesus, sometimes it's Foden, although not really much this season. Like, you have very rarely, if ever, seen this season a left-sided winger stay wide. And that means that Cancelo, in the attacking third when necessary, occupies those spaces, except he's right-footed. And that is kind of a problem in terms of having a well-oiled machine here. And what it mostly means is that Cancelo is giving you a ton of productive work in build-up, and he's giving you... I mean, he's a very good player, so he's giving you above-average fullback work in the final third, but he's not, say, giving you, like, superior production there. Not that, like, City have ever had a left back that did, and not that, like, Mendy, when he's starting as, like, a left-footed traditional overlapping left back, is giving them, like, anything super useful, and they don't want, like, overlapping crosses, but, like, you still need spacing. And so what you have is just a little bit less ability to overwhelm opposition boxes, even while you have a tremendous amount of ability still to get the ball up and in the area. So you end up, rather than slicing apart defenses, you end up sort of pinning them in a lot more. And you're not taking it over. You are still attempting to find great shots despite having pinned them in. And that is, like, That is not an easy thing to do, and City do it certainly well enough, given how great they have become defensively with this setup, to be statistically, you know, one of the best three teams in the Premier League. But it's very hard to create the overwhelming amount of attack when you approach it that way.
Yeah, so I mean, City the only team in the Premier League that's conceded fewer than 100 shots. They're also interestingly the only team in the Premier League that's conceded fewer than 100 crosses, which sort of shows you what they're doing.
Right.
They never soak up pressure. They never let you get in. They control the game to keep you from ever being in a position to even make low quality attacking chances. And they're quite good at it. They've also now, like, they've really shut down. They're one of the league leaders in the fewest shots from direct attacks conceded as well. So they have just shut that down entirely. What's interesting is that while they are trying to get great shots, their expected goals per shot is pretty average.
Yep.
And what they are trying to, but eventually they end up just sort of, what they end up with is a lot of shots from inside the penalty area with a lot of defenders there.
That's right.
And quite a few shots from outside the penalty area from, like, De Bruyne, which, you know, some more of those will go in. And they are, what we've seen from them in their last few games, really, is, I mean, the City games have become, like, some of the most predictable games in the Premier League. Total control, not very fun to watch. It really matters a lot if one of those early shots goes in, because they don't end up committing to the attack until relatively late. And it can get, I think that what I see in this question is, remember the question? We're still talking about the question. What I see in this question is that it is kind of underestimated how hard it is to move the ball into the final third and to the area around the penalty area when most of your players are being positioned so conservatively. It takes, in fact, great passing to have the kind of control and possession in the final third on the penalty area that City do. But because very few of their players take up aggressive positions, it ends up leading to what looks like less creative football. And is, like, in some objective sense, less creative football. But it's not less creative because the passers are bad. It's less creative because they have many fewer players to pass it to.
All right. You want to hit me with another question eventually here?
Eventually. So let's move away from City, who are just, like, good, to I like this question, but it's going to take us in a couple of different directions and touch on a team that is also good. This is from Charles Dallimore. Asks, other than Klopp, which Premier League manager is currently getting the best results given their squad? And do you expect that to be the same answer at the end of the season? And who's having a better season given their squad to Lampard early? So there's three really, really different questions here. But let's just take the first one.
So is who other than Klopp is getting the most out of their squad?
Yeah.
This depends on the premise of the question. Sorry. Like, it is an unfortunate reality that Brighton are very far down the table. But if you were to tell me based on performance who is getting the best out of their squad, I think there's a strong argument that Graham Potter is second.
That was going to be my answer.
Yeah.
I mean, wasn't even going to couch it. It's just Graham Potter.
Well, I mean, the problem here is that, like, if you don't couch it, then, like you can't really ignore Aston Villa here, can you?
Yeah, you can't, but also, I think that that does get to the premise of the question, which is, like, what do you do with the fact that Jack Grealish is now Mega Hazard?
Yeah, right.
Like, do you have to give Dean Smith some credit for turning a player into something I didn't even knew existed beforehand. But, you know, right now they're just, like, being carried by one of the great individual seasons of the modern Premier League era.
I mean, yes, but, like, Villa could be set up in a way such that we would never have discovered that Jack Grealish could be Mega Hazard, right? Like that is the thing. If you were playing Grealish as an 8 with a very lightweight 8 next to him and a crappy 6 behind him, he would be having to do a lot more defensive work, and you would be touching the ball a lot less around the box, and you honestly might just never see him doing this. Even if he was capable, you would just never know that he was capable of this until perhaps another manager came in or something, right? Like it is a difficult question here of overlap in that way. I think the flip side of that, right, is that, like, Graham Potter doesn't have anybody who is obviously doing that. So, like, there is no question, right? like there is no, oh my God, you have a superstar for Graham Potter. He's just, like, getting really good performances out of, like, his entire team of mediocre players. And maybe, like, some are somewhat better than we expected, but nobody's, like, blowing you away. Which is why that's where I would settle, I think.
Yeah, there was a that Che Ho, who's at Taxa Platform, put together like a table of the a graphic of what passes different what passes different teams make the most often, and like there's all sorts of like, you know, clustering and technical questions after this. But the thing that is most striking about that up to me about this is the way that Aston Villa, like, you can actually see their passes moving the ball from the goalkeeper to Jack Grealish.
Yeah,
like the passes that they make the most often are the passes that most quickly get the ball to your creative left winger to do stuff,
and he just keeps doing stuff and keeps doing stuff and keeps doing stuff and keeps doing stuff.
He's like, it's hard to overstate how good a season he's having. Like, because the amount of shot creation that he's doing is greater than the amount of shot creation that Eden Hazard did.
With lesser talent around him.
He's not as great a finisher as Hazard, and so Hazard would always get, like, a lot of goals for a relatively small amount of XG, and, like, you have to give him credit for that. But he is moving the ball into the penalty area by passing or by dribbling, like, 4, 5, 6 times per match, just on his own. And that leads to so, and given that Villa are doing that while not having as much possession as top teams, like, this is a stupid great season. I'm trying to think of any individual player season from a player outside of the top.
Mahrez on Leicester a little bit, but it's different because he was, like, yeah. he had Vardy with him.
Payet and West Ham.
Yeah.
Although, but, like, that this was is better so than much either of those.
Yeah.
This is clearly better than either of those.
Payet was so much from set pieces. It's hard. It's really hard to think of a guy who has done this much on a team that was, you know, forget mid-table. I mean, they were like a relegation-threatened team, like, coming in. Like, clearly. Like, we had a big old discussion about whether I was being too generous by thinking they were, like, 15th-ish.
Yeah,
And
they're, you know, top 5, top 6 in all the metrics, including, like, winning games.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's an argument, like, by, like, you could make a pretty compelling argument that they're the 4th best team in the Premier League right now by, like, pretty much any metric you want to make. And we're at the point in the season where it's not like you should expect that to stop being the case. I mean, it is not like, based on statistics, you should expect that to stop being the case.
Now, you
make an argument, but, like,
Yeah, there's evidence that teams with lower payrolls do worse in the holiday fixtures pile up, presumably because they have less money to have, you know, deeper squads to manage this. So far, this is not happening with Villa at all, who have been dominating their games. They didn't win all of them, but they've been dominating them. And they've just got a couple more to get through.
I do wonder if the compressed schedule of this year messes with that.
I wonder the exact same thing, yeah. Is everyone struggling anyway? Like, does it kind of doesn't even matter?
Right, exactly.
But I do sort of want to go back around to Brighton for a minute because, yeah. Like, they're not having an obvious individual standout season.
No, they're not. I mean, I guess, like, Trossard's probably having a pretty good year. But, like, that's, like, the most you can get to.
Right. And they are still playing, like, mostly, you know, it's recognizably the same kind of stuff that Graham Potter did last season.
Yeah.
And last season, our story of Brighton was, look how you can change a team's style massively while not changing the output significantly. And now that same style, and they're sped up a little bit more. They're pressing a little bit more. They have a little bit less easy possession. But it's just become way more effective defensively.
Yes. And in attack, too, incidentally. Sort of by underlying numbers. They are a perfectly average attacking side. They are just also, like, a really excellent defensive side.
Yeah. All right, so, you know...
Should we do the other parts of this question?
Yeah, why not?
All right, so do you expect the answer to the end to be the same at the end of the season? Well, I'm mildly concerned that Graham Potter is going to get fired because Brighton's so far down the table. despite the fact that I think he's doing a phenomenal job, so, like, possibly not.
Yeah. And I also think it's interesting we haven't actually talked about Ralf Hasenhüttl here.
Yeah, that's a
fair
point.
And I think we should have because I still don't like the talent on the Southampton team. Like, they are significantly overperforming their XG. They're kind of a, like, league average side. This is not a league average side by talent, I don't think. And
yeah,
to the degree that they are, it's because he is squeezing a lot of production out of some relatively limited players and, like, very quickly developing, like, a Kyle Walker-Peters into a capable defensive fullback.
Yeah, developing Kyle Walker-Peters, like, getting production out of Shea Adam, who, I mean, is young enough that you can believe maybe he's going to be a good player, but, like, certainly hadn't shown, like, super promise. And honestly, this year isn't even putting up huge numbers, even though you're getting production out of him. Yeah, I mean, Hasenhüttl has to be on, like, this list. All right, before we get out of here, let's finish up the question with question number. Part of the reason we get through so few of your questions is, like, all of your questions are, like, multi-part, I'm at a conference, hand me the mic questions, which, like, to be fair, is something we should expect from our audience, so I should not complain. But let us get to part three of this single question, which is who is having the better season given their squad, Lampard or Ole?
It's really more of a comment. But, yeah, I mean, Lampard is, at this point, I think, getting good production out of this squad. The thing he's doing, I'm still not entirely sold that this Chelsea team can be this good defensive. Like, basically what he's gotten this team to do now is this is a good defensive team because of much more conservative fullback tactics and to a certain degree less conservative midfield, more conservative midfield tactics. That works because Ziyech creates amazing things, but recently with Ziyech out, they're finding ways to make that work with Pulisic, with Werner,
They haven't really figured out a way to make it work with Havertz, but like,
which is,
he is recognizing the quality of creative attacking talent that he has, and that allows him to not tell Ben Chilwell and Reece James to go attack, which they're quite good at, because when you tell them to go attack, it leaves lots of space open.
Right, and
to be
so
attacked.
you get quality attacking out of Reece James, who's now hurt for some period of time, but not quantity, and you get fine attacking, you know, contributions out of Ben Chilwell, but again, not quantity. And you're relying on Ziyech a lot, and then he gets hurt, and like, you know, at some point here, what they've basically done is scraped through. And that's a fine allocation of resources if you're making it work. But, like, at some point, what if you, like, at some point, it still feels to me like there's too much attacking talent to be struggling without Ziyech, even accounting for holding, you know, sort of positionally conservative fullbacks. And it just hasn't bitten them yet. Now, that said, like, they're a contender for the title, clearly. And they should be with this talent.
And today they very solidly beat a West Ham side whose manager we should have mentioned in the last question for a minute, because they managed a couple times to get, like, really good chances on the break.
Right.
Through Pulisic and Werner in particular. And if you can occasionally break against a David Moyes side, like, you're doing something right.
Yeah.
Like, I'm increasingly believing that this just works because he's been given such good talent and he's making it work. And that's not bad. I don't know. I'm still, like, both these managers, like, they're not terrible. Like,
see, that's the other thing about United, is that because they've had such a weird season, you don't realize that on a points per game basis, they have the second best haul in the Premier League. And, like, it's, they've gotten a lot of penalties, which skew their statistics. But, like, they're a top, easily a top five side by, like statistically. Even, you know, like, depending on how you want to account for penalties. Like, they're, in the Premier League, they have been a pretty good team. And they have less talent than Chelsea. By, like, I don't know, like, a not insignificant margin. Which, to be fair, is more of a depth issue than a everybody's first choice 11 issue, I think. But, like, when Chelsea's first 11 is out there, they have no holes. When Manchester United's first 11 is out there, you don't even know who their first 11 is in defensive midfield. Or at right wing, really. And so, like, to me, your baseline for seeing how their talent has developed this season is that Chelsea should be better, and they are better. But I, like, have a real hard time picking, like, who is doing better in relation to their talent. I guess technically, like, if you're gonna, like, lean on points, I'd say United. But, you know, if you're looking at underlying performances, maybe Chelsea.
Right. If you assume that Ole isn't the one winning them tons of penalties still.
Right.
You know. But, like, I just, like, the thing with, it's kind of the interesting thing where, because Chelsea's recruitment has been so much better, then, yeah, you know, Lampard doing a pretty good job leads to something much more impressive than Ole doing a pretty good job.
Yes.
But at the same time, it also means that you look at Chelsea and you're like, well, what if they had a really good manager who wasn't just doing a pretty good job? Like, there's a lot more upside at the top end of that if you replace Lampard with a, you know, one of the best managers in the world that you can pay for with Roman's money.
Yeah.
Whereas for United, like, you're getting something pretty good, and you still don't have a great roster. Like, you know, maybe you're pushing on a little bit more toward top four with a better manager, but you're in the top four race as it is. You're doing okay. Like,
well, but
the
flip side of that is if you're in the top four race, every marginal point a better manager could get you is, like, super duper valuable.
Yeah, in terms of money, maybe you're more worried about that, whereas the title doesn't actually win you any money. It's just, like, you know, the flag flies forever.
Yeah, I don't know. How you judge those things, I don't know.
All right. Well, that seems like our podcast. And to answer a question from Chad Stolper about the non-soccer thing, yes, that's going to come back after the pandemic. That's where we stand. We miss it as well, but that's going to come back after the pandemic.
Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.